Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Steele Brand, Associate Professor of History at the King's College in New York City. This is episode CLXXVII, The Battle of Philippi. More than 2 years have passed since the death of Caesar, and we have now come to the final battle of the Liberators' War. Octavian and Mark Antony lead their forces west to confront Cassius and Brutus, who have amassed quite the army in the meantime. Here's Steele Brand.
The Battle of Philippi is the decisive battle that determines whether or not the Roman Republic will indeed remain a republic, or whether it will transition into some form of autocratic rule. And the defeat, ultimately, of the Republican forces means that the Roman Republic, which has become a Roman Empire in the sense that it controls a vast swath of territory, now it's also imperial in the sense that it's run by what we would describe as an emperor, one-man rule.
Was it the intention for this to be the final battle, the final confrontation? If all sides had their own way, would this have been how they ended it? I don't know if they were prepared fully, if this is where they wanted to hold it, or was it more of a this is just how it happened kind of scenario?
There are lots of battles in history where the latter that you just described, where it just sort of happened that way. In fact, more often than not, the quote-unquote decisive battles that we read about in history, they almost accidentally will lead to things, or there's a major event, but it doesn't seem major at the time. Mm. But I think at the Battle of Philippi, even before this has happened, everyone involved realizes, if you're on the Republican side, if we lose, there's no more a republic. And on the autocratic side, if we lose, you know, we're toast, we're dead. And our vision of a Roman Empire that is run by someone like a Julius Caesar, that will end with us. So I think it is one of these immense moments in history, very, very rare, but when everyone realizes, okay, everything's on the line. And the speeches that were given by the historians, which are really good and possibly largely invented, I think in some ways we can grant them a little bit of credence, because it seems that everyone who is there at least understands what they're fighting for and what stakes are on the line. It's also a huge battle. I mean, it's the largest number of Roman forces ever gathered, because they're all fighting each other. So that in and of itself tells you that this battle, even before it's fought, is going to be determinative.
Okay, so can you take me through what forces we have assembled and what their motivations are at this point?
Sure. For simplicity's sake, we'll just sort of summarize the commanders and the causes that they represent. Yeah. So on the one hand, we have the triumvirs. Oftentimes they're called the second triumvirate, but this is three people who've come together basically to try and maintain the legacy of Julius Caesar, who only 2 years previously had been assassinated. Mm. The triumvirs are Lepidus, who remains back at home in Rome, and then you have the two that are in the theater in Philippi, Octavian, who I think we could call the young Caesar. That would probably have been the name that he would have preferred, and it's the name that has brought him a lot of attention, because that draws Julius Caesar's forces to his banner. And the reason that he is called the young Caesar is that although he's not Caesar's son, he has been designated as Caesar's heir in Caesar's will. And so he stands to inherit not only the property that Caesar has designated, but also the name, the prestige for Julius Caesar. That's our second man. And I mentioned him second because at this point in history, Octavian, who will become Augustus and is huge in our minds for what happens later on in history, he's playing third fiddle. He's the one that's not as important. Probably the most important figure, or almost certainly the most important figure for the triumvirs, for the ones who want to maintain the legacy of Julius Caesar, is Mark Antony. Mark Antony, if he's not heir of Caesar's political legacy, he's the heir of his charisma. He's the heir of his military decision-making, his military experience. Of all the commanders on the field, he's definitely the best in a dire tactical situation. He has lots of experience with Caesar. He had been consul when Caesar was assassinated, and he's the one who's trying to say, I'm the man who's the best representative of Caesar. That's one side. Mm. These three men, who are basically allies merely out of convenience, expediency, they have no moral attachment to one another. In fact, they're eventually all going to put each other aside or prompt the deaths of each other.
And they probably already know that that's on the horizon as well, that
they do.
They're going to have to deal with each other after they've dealt with the liberators.
That's right. In fact, when Octavian arrives on the scene in the middle of 44, when he arrives to take up the mantle of Caesar, he and Antony come to blows several times, but also they collect armies, and the soldiers won't fight each other because they all like the legacy of Caesar, but the men very much want to duke it out. And so when they come together and they're joined by Lepidus, and that second triumvirate, as it's called today, is formed, many people are shocked that this has happened, but everyone realizes these are opportunists. And right now, they need each other. But when this is all over, if they are successful, they will almost certainly part ways. Mm. That's one side, the group of people trying to maintain the legacy of Caesar. Then we've got the other side, those standing up for the Republican cause. And I mentioned that I wanted to pay attention to the leaders in particular, but Brutus and Cassius, or I should say Cassius and Brutus, are the ones that have gone down in history as the last fighters of the Roman Republic, supposed to represent what the Republic has stood for. And I think that's mostly correct. Both of them stem from very, very old Republican families. They have been a part of the Republican system, but they still deeply believe in the Republican system. So Antony, Lepidus, not so much Octavian, but Antony and Lepidus, they've also risen in the Republican system, but they're ready for something new. Mm. Brutus and Cassius are part of these old families that still believe that the Republic should indeed be a Republic, and it shouldn't transition to anything else. And so they're the ones who lead the conspiracy that assassinated Julius Caesar, which I'm sure you've covered in other podcasts. And so I won't go into those sorts of details, but they've taken up this mantle of the Republican cause. Now, there are a number of other conspirators, possibly in the 20s. There are a number of other senators that we know are there in the Republican camp. They've fled because the triumvirs have taken over Italy. And so they're all over in the East. There are a number of other people who are involved. But just for simplicity's sake, I think these five men that I've mentioned, particularly the four that are there, Octavian and Antony on the triumvirate side, and Brutus and Cassius, they represent not merely opposing military forces, but opposing ideologies for what the future of Rome will be.
Okay, and if we could get a sense of what sort of forces are facing each other. So these are both essentially Roman armies. So I feel that there would be conflicting feelings about fighting against fellow Romans, and these kind of elements do come up in the speeches that they give to their troops. There also might be a sense of urgency. You've got two large military forces with large needs. They need to be fed, they need to be paid. The triumvirate just had a round of proscriptions in Rome, which kind of filled the coffers to some extent. But you kind of have a bit of an urgent need to this battle and a conflicting kind of feeling going into it. Is that about right?
There are a lot of conflicts that are going on. There are lots of conflicted feelings, and it's not only with the great men, if you will, of this moment. And that's where I think we need to set aside the great man of history idea. It always has its limitations. And the deepest conflict, I think, are in those soldiers who had fought with Julius Caesar under the Republican order. And there's this round of civil wars where many of these same soldiers who had fought with him in other battles on behalf of the Republic, particularly in Gaul, many of these soldiers had decided to fight for Julius Caesar in a civil war, not necessarily understanding that Julius Caesar had a different sort of form of government in mind. So the citizen soldiers themselves are oftentimes controlling what the individual commanders will do. They have a lot of power and they're all very conflicted. So some of them, like Brutus and Cassius, believe in the Republic. Some of them have fought for Caesar, yet they still believe in the Republic, and so they're conflicted. Some of them have fought for Caesar, and they believe that, hey, whoever can give me the most money, these are the guys that I'm going to serve. Some of them fought for Caesar, and they favor an autocratic form of government. There's a spectrum of what many of the average citizen soldiers, because Rome does not have a professional army, they've got a citizen soldier army, even though they are sort of professionalized. But all of these sub-commanders on the field, many even of the senior commanders under the two generals on each side, they have a lot of different emotions going on. And Cassius in particular, I stress Cassius over and against Brutus as the primary leader because it seems Brutus is the most important philosophically in leading the Republican cause. But Cassius is the one that has a lot more military experience. And Cassius is really good at understanding the Roman soldier. And so he gets up and he speaks in front of a number of these citizen soldiers that have fought for Caesar and yet are in his army. And he explains to them, hey, look, we all valued Caesar. Cassius himself had served under Caesar several times. We all saw how good he was. The problem with Caesar, however, was that he wanted to make himself the Republic, and that's not who we are, and that's not what Rome has been. And so you can have fought for Caesar, and it's okay to fight against his heirs. In fact, it's necessary. Because you are not soldiers of Caesar, you're soldiers of Rome. And it's this speech that is put into his mouth by Appian. The sentiments in it, I think, are there, even if the specific words that Appian gives us aren't necessarily the ones that he used. I think that's what Cassius is arguing for. That's how he's able to unify all of these disparate forces, some of whom had fought against Caesar in the Civil War, some of whom had fought with him, but he binds them all together. And so the forces on his side understand they are fighting for an idea. But on the other side, for the triumvirs, there's a different conflict going on. And the speeches that were given by Mark Antony are very short, and they're very much to the point. We've got to crush these guys, and we want to steal everything they've got. And by the way, after we crush them and we take everything they have here, we're going to give you things back in Italy and other places. We'll sell new colonies. We'll give you benefits. And he's sort of appealing to their avarice. Every soldier has this sort of appeal, particularly in the ancient world. Plunder is a part of what motivates many people when they're in battle. It's just a totally different sentiment. And so many of the soldiers, the citizen soldiers that are fighting for him, have already started to transition into this very different kind of army where I fight for the commander and what he can give me. And so again, there are conflicts, there's a spectrum. But when it comes down to it, I think which side you're on, somewhere at the root of these are a very different idea of what military service means, what Rome should look like, and who I actually owe my allegiance to.
Mm-hmm. Do they get the responses that they want from their military? I mean, they're two very different arguments that they're putting forward. I'm just wondering if the men completely buy into those kind of arguments.
I think the men very much understand what, for example, Antony and Octavian and Lepidus represent. They know the background of the forming of the triumvirate. They understand these men had fought against each other before their armies were formed together. They also understand that with the proscriptions, and so they know, well, okay, there are rewards that I can accrue under them, and they've already seen this happen. But they also, I think a lot of these guys think, but I'm fighting for the legacy of Caesar, and I'm loyal to Caesar, and Caesar was stupendous. Sort of like the way that maybe soldiers would have felt about a MacArthur or a Patton or a Montgomery, if we're looking, for example, in the conflicts in the mid-20th century. On the other side, you've got soldiers who are with Brutus and Cassius. They understand that we have this cause, but we've also been paid. Both sides have paid their men, and Brutus and Cassius have basically fleeced the eastern portions of the empire to levy an enormous amount of money, a war chest, and they've paid their men. The triumvirs, on the other hand, they are a little overstretched by the time they get to the battlefield of Philippi. So when they get there, it's a question, are they actually going to be able to pay the men? Instead, they're making a lot of promises. Mm. So on one hand, there are questions about, are we actually going to get what we are paid? But the only way for either side to guarantee that they get to keep what they've paid or get what they've been promised is to win the battle. That's part of what's going on. I think the other aspect, and you have to think about this from the perspective of commanders, if you just look at the last several decades of Roman warfare, and there have been a series of civil wars, you have had a number of commanders that have suffered numerous mutinies. They've been assassinated by their own troops. They've been beheaded, stoned. There are armies that have taken the field, and then entire units have defected to the other side. The commanders themselves realize this is a volatile situation, and these citizen soldiers, they might turn against me at any moment in time. There's a lot more of that on the side of the triumvirs, because I think those ideas aren't there to inspire. There's a lot less of that on the part of Cassius and Brutus, not only because they have this deeper idea of, hey, this is what Rome has always stood for, and that's what you should fight for. But also because they've been so good and so thorough at maintaining the pay of their troops, and the troops have also seen how closely Brutus and Cassius work together. And that's the kind of guy you want to fight for. You want to follow someone in battle who's been loyal to his friend. And so that's inspiring on just a purely tactical and military standpoint. Mm. So those factors are there, and they certainly matter when the battles begin.
Can we talk about the forces now to the extent of who's got the larger army and who's better outfitted? And also, where is Philippi and why was the battle there?
Yeah, let's talk about the armies. The triumvirs have a slightly larger number of legions. They've got 19 legions. They're not all the same number. It's around 110,000 men. The liberators, that is Brutus and Cassius, the Republican forces, they've got about 17 legions and 90,000 men. And like many Roman Republican battles or wars in the past, these legions have been brought together relatively recently. However, it hasn't been straight up conscription the way it normally has been. Instead, it's been more like you've got Republican warlords that have cobbled together around 90,000 guys in 17 legions, and then you've got autocratic warlords from the West, and they've cobbled together 19 legions, around 110,000. And this is a huge amount of manpower. Mm. Estimates are that it's like one legionary to about 11 and a half citizens, one legionary to about 2.5 of the younger men. And Plutarch himself says that Roman forces of such a size has never been encountered before in history. And that's quite significant. The men know this when they're going into it. And the numbers, we're not entirely certain. How much does it include all the allies? So part of Brutus and Cassius' army are allies that they've brought into the battle, which the Roman armies typically, historically, have been half citizens and then half allies. And so they've brought a number of their own allies from the east over into their forces. And it's interesting because Brutus and Cassius, when they bring some of the forces in, they argue with them. They're having to defeat some of the powers out in the east. But when they bring these allies in, the arguments they make for them are, hey, look, if you like this arrangement that you've got under the Roman Republic, you have to fight for us because we're going to keep that arrangement. But if you don't, not only will Republican freedom be lost, but your notions of freedom is guaranteed by the Roman Republic in the past under a different order. Well, your notions of freedom are going to end as well. It's interesting that he's able to do this. I think they're successful, and there are more allies. There are greater variety in Brutus and Cassius' forces, but it does not seem to negate their military power on the eve of the battle. And in fact, they seem to be just as well suited. In one way, and this gets us to the position, the Battle of Philippi takes place in what we think of as Greece. It's a site that was founded by Philip of Macedon, so technically it would be in Macedonian territory, and it's actually named after Philip of Macedon. So this is a site that's been around for several hundred years, at least under its current name. Ever since the Romans conquered Macedon or incorporated them into their government in the second century, and there was a long process for that, but it's been incorporated for quite some time. The reason that we're at Philippi is because the liberators, Brutus and Cassius, had gone to the east after a lot of problems emerged with the assassination of Caesar. And so they go out east. This is a tried and tested method on the part of other commanders in history. For example, a guy like Sulla. But another famous commander, a guy by the name of Pompey, had done the same thing, and it didn't work out as well for him, although it might have. So the idea being, we're going to go out to the east, we're going to get all the resources together, and we're going to use those resources to retake the west. Because in the west, this is where the triumvirs have been victorious in the last war against, really led by a guy who didn't even fight in the war, but a guy by the name of Marcus Tullius Cicero. And so the liberators have their armies that they've gathered from the west, and they are forced to move to the position of the liberators because the triumvirs need a victory. They need to end this. They need to end Brutus and Cassius. How long that our little coalition is going to hold together is an open question. And so that's why it's fought in the sort of in-between world in Macedon at this site at Philippi.
Mm. And regarding the terrain in particular, I believe that Cassius and Brutus get there first and essentially occupy the high ground, if I can call it that. They definitely get the good spots in this battle.
There's no question. This is a huge part of the narrative. It's overstated a little bit, but let me describe their situation. So they're at Philippi. They have access to the sea. Cassius and Brutus chase away Saxa and Norbanus. These are two sub-commanders of the triumvirs. They do have a really good small military operation. They move these two guys out from the heights around Philippi. They push them back to the coast further west, and they occupy the site of Philippi. What is good for Brutus and Cassius is they're near the city. They occupy the city. They have the city in their back. But more importantly, they have a route to the sea. And the Republicans, as it just so happens, control the sea. Two major fleets out there and a minor fleet. The minor fleet is all that the triumvirs have, and they're not doing well. There's a giant fleet under the control of a son of Pompey the Great. He's still sort of holding out for dad's ideas. Pompey is dead, but he's taken up the legacy. So Pompeius has one of the fleets. They're sort of working with the Republicans, and the Republicans themselves do a no small part to Cassius' good leadership and others in the Republican position. They have another sizable fleet. So they control the seas. And that means that they've got an open route from Philippi down to the open seas, and they've got endless supplies that they can gain. So what they have to do is they have to maintain control of the road down to the sea. So what they do is they basically set up a line in between the heights behind Philippi and a swampy marsh area. And as long as they hold that position, they can sit and hold out forever. So that's a really, really good position. Numerical inferiority, but strategic superiority. Okay, now let's look at the triumvirs. The triumvirs have a devil of a time getting from Italy over to the area where they can encounter Brutus and Cassius. But one thing that is surprising, it's alarming, it's almost foreboding, is how quickly Mark Antony moves. So they managed to finally get all their ships across and enough men. They have a lot of trouble, but they're able to do it. And Antony makes a dash from the coast to the site of Philippi. And everyone's very surprised how fast he moves. Just like Julius Caesar, his mentor, he knows how to take advantage of a strategic position. And he also knows when he's got a disadvantage. And he sees this right away. Now, with him is Octavian. Octavian has a tendency to be ill at some of the most dangerous moments in any military event. So he's sick at the time. He seems to suffer perhaps a little bit from physical cowardice. Politically, he's as brave as a lion. He's amazing. But and when it comes to a physical contest, that bravery wanes. He's attacked frequently by his enemies as a coward. So he's sick, but he sort of makes his way eventually to the camp. But it's pretty clear that Antony is going to be the one in charge. The triumvirs set up two different camps, and Antony is sort of opposite Cassius, and Octavian is opposite Brutus. The only major flaw between Brutus and Cassius in their positioning is that they have a huge distance between their camps. And that's going to be very important for what happens, because that's going to limit their command and control. What they're going to be able to tell what's going on and communicate with each other during a battle. But the position's solid. Compare that to the triumvirs. They've gotten there fast, but they don't have supplies and they can't get supplies. And their position is lower down. Your description of the high ground is pretty close to correct, because they're on the other side of a small river or creek and closer down to the swamps, and it's kind of malarial. People are going to be getting more sick more frequently. They don't have enough supplies. That's going to lead to malnutrition. So there's this cycle that Antony knows is going to start wearing down his men. So he needs a battle. Whereas the Brutus and Cassius, they know this as well. So they just need to hold out and stay put. And this is the situation that we have when both forces are arrayed for battle.
You said that there were two battles in the Battle of Philippi, but the first one seems to be very much provoked by Antony. I get a sense of impatience in the way that he's operating and that he's really trying to push a confrontation. So Antony goes for Cassius's camp in an impatient manner, and it's therefore Brutus who takes the opportunity or is provoked in return into going for Octavian's forces.
Right. I love the way you just described it, because that's a good description. But in some ways, it's not entirely correct. And here's why. Everything you said is right. Antony, it's not as much impatience, but as much as it's like he has to take the initiative. He knows he has to. No supplies, bad position. And so what Antony does is he starts building this causeway to outflank Cassius. It's brilliant.
Across the swamp?
Through the swamp, in the swamp. And when it's nighttime, they're doing this under the cover of darkness. When it's daytime, he has all his men get up and be arrayed for battle. The Republicans aren't going to come out and fight because that would be foolish. What this does is that distracts them. And so he builds this causeway, and it's only until very late that Cassius realizes, oh my goodness, he's going to outflank me. They already have fortified positions, and now the whole Republican left flank is going to be open. When this happens, he starts building a counter causeway, like a road or a wall in between. It's here. This is where you're right. This is where Antony decides, well, we just have to attack. He takes the initiative when Cassius has been cut off, and he just totally changes basically the game they're playing. It's almost like Cassius and Antony are playing chess.
Mm.
And it seems like Cassius is winning. And Antony says, well, okay, we're just going to swipe all the pieces off the board, and now we're going to start playing checkers. And so he changes the game, and Cassius doesn't know what to do. And here's what I mean by that. Antony just leads a direct assault in the middle of this construction activity against Cassius' camp. But here is where the description of the commanders operating sort of breaks down. This is what I was talking about, where we get away from the accuracy of Antony doing this or Brutus doing that. Instead, it's the men that are doing this. Citizen soldiers, these guys who have all this initiative. And Antony's men basically attack Cassius' camp, and they get out of the control of Antony. And they do so well, they overwhelm Cassius' camp. Cassius himself has to flee. Many of the men only have like pickaxes and shovels and things of this nature because they've been doing construction. Well, this is falling apart on the Republican left, and Cassius is desperately trying to rally his men as Antony's men are just overwhelming him. Brutus men, not Brutus, but Brutus soldiers see what's going on, and they decide to attack Octavian's position. Brutus, if he'd been in command, would have said, no men, instead, follow me. We're going to go to the aid of Cassius. And the battle probably would have been ended in a Republican victory. But instead, what ends up happening is Brutus men, without their commander, take off and go charge Octavian. Now, fortunately for the Republicans, the citizen soldiers fighting for Brutus are overwhelmingly victorious. And so what happens is Antony is victorious on the Republican left, and Brutus, sort of, his men, are victorious on the Roman right. Now, where's Octavian? Supposedly had a premonition a few days before.
An omen, yeah.
That's right, an omen, correct. And because of the omen, he sneaks out, and Pliny says that he's hiding in a swampy area. Maybe he's ill, or maybe he's following the gods, or whatever it may be. So he's not even there. But Brutus, his soldiers have won one side. Antony's soldiers have won the other. But all order has broken down. It's mayhem. And we had this really, really vivid description of what happens because night is going to settle the issue. Night will end, as it does with most battles in the pre-modern world. It will end the battle. The men have occupied the opposing camps, and they're going to come back that night filled with loot. I can't remember if it's Appian or who says it, but someone, one of the historians says they looked more like porters, you know, carrying luggage or goods, tradesmen or something like this, than they looked like soldiers. And this is how the first battle ends, except for one major event. And I think this is probably the most decisive event of the entire day. So this one decisive event is Cassius. So describe what happens in the battle, describe how the battle ends. But in the midst of all of this, Cassius has lost total control of his forces. He's retreated to a high point, one of those high points around the area of Philippi. And he's trying to figure out what has happened, what's going on. But there's so much dust that has been kicked up by all the troop movements that he can't see what has occurred. He knows that both lines are totally engaged. So he sends out a sub-commander, a guy by the name of Titinius. He sends him out to go find out what's happened to Brutus. I have to know what's happened to Brutus. Clearly, I've lost. I don't know how much I've lost, but clearly I've lost. But you've got to tell me what has happened. And so Titinius goes out, and he supposedly, and this is where the information gets a little garbled because we have different sources saying different things. Titinius goes out, and he finds out what has happened to Brutus. But instead of racing back to tell Cassius, Titinius delays. He's delayed in celebrations. And Cassius can't really see. Why is Titinius delayed? Has he been captured? Is it all bad? Seeing this, he interprets Titinius' delay as an utter and complete defeat. And so Cassius kills himself. He's taken an Epicurean view of suicide, and he thinks all is lost, out of the shame. He kills himself. It's characteristic of a philosophical conviction, but otherwise not very characteristic of Cassius' leadership. And it's a horrible choice. Now, some say that's not what happened. Titinius makes it back, and Titinius then tells him, oh no, Brutus won. And when Cassius hears this, then he's shamed because he didn't do his part, and he kills himself. But in the earlier account, Cassius is already dead. And when Titinius gets there, he is so ashamed that he didn't make it back to tell Cassius that, no, we've actually won. So Titinius kills himself. And yet a third version of the account, a slave of Cassius, kills him. I don't buy that one bit. As much as I really like Cassius, I think Cassius kills himself because he gives in to this sort of cult of suicide that had emerged in the first century BC. And this decision by Cassius to basically abandon reason, decide either all was lost or I can't outlive this shame or I can't come back and fight again. Really, really, really bad decision. And to abandon his troops, I think that's the moment the scales tip in favor of the triumvirs.
It very much strikes me as a scene out of a Shakespearean tragedy of, I don't know what's happening in this battle. I think that we've been defeated. I'm going to kill myself. And then you get scenes, depending on who's telling the account of it, of Brutus coming across the body and lamenting this and weeping over him, called him the last of the Romans, meaning that his equal in virtue would never exist again. That's from Appian. But there's so many question marks over how it happened and who it affected. Ultimately, that will affect the outcome of the next battle and the Philippi in total and the cause.
It will. And here's why. Cassius was this really great military leader. He'd been famous for, not really great, I mean, compared to a Julius Caesar or, you know, a Pompey the Great, he's not that great, but he's a really good military commander.
Compared to Brutus?
Compared to Brutus. And we'll see that in what plays out with the second battle of Philippi and really what happens in between. Brutus is, he's a fair commander. He's not a dunce, but his gifts lie elsewhere with philosophy or with teaching or with oratory or argumentation. That's going to tell. Well, the first thing that Brutus has to do is he's got to deal with the body of Cassius. And you're right, it breaks him. This is his close friend. These two have worked so closely together. Unlike the triumvirs, they have made sacrifices for each other. They pledged their loyalty to each other, and then they had fulfilled all of those. And it's a beautiful picture of friendship between these two. So I think the weeping on the part of Brutus is absolutely genuine. I think it would have happened. But there's also another side of this, and that's Brutus realizing, oh my gosh, this is all up to me. And I don't get the sense he's someone who wanted it to be that way, if we believe anything that we're told in the sources. He could be decisive, but that decisiveness, if it's there, is going to totally evaporate. So what does he do with the body? He has to send it away because he doesn't want a big funeral. The way Cassius has died has been horrible. That a commander would abandon his troops, that's a really, really discouraging sign. So he sort of sends it back to the sea. They have a private funeral elsewhere. And so now he has taken over. And meanwhile, as Brutus is like wrestling with all this, he's done something really, really foolish. He's abandoned one of the crucial hills that help maintain their good position. And the lines have now shifted, and Antony has achieved what he wanted, and that is he's been able to outflank that Roman position. So the lines sort of shift. They shift in some ways really, really great for the triumvirate, and in some ways still really problematic. So the triumvirs, they have the opportunity, if they keep extending their line out toward the sea, to cut off Brutus from the sea and remove that logistical superiority that Brutus and Cassius had enjoyed. Now, on the other hand, they're still in really, really bad terrain, and their lines are now extending into the swamps. This is awful. And they still don't control the sea, so it's not like they can get supplies and Brutus can't. The best they could do is just cut off Brutus, and they still won't be able to get supplies. So they need a battle to happen. And this is where Antony again shows his brilliance. And he's the decisive mover and shaker in the battle. So he's already got there faster. It was his cat and mouse game with Cassius that set off the first battle of Philippi. Victory over Cassius that caused that decisive bad decision by Cassius. And so now Antony is going to start a PSYOPs campaign. I mean, it's brilliant. He has pamphlets that are made up. And these pamphlets, they start throwing them over the Republican lines. And they start telling all of the troops, now, what are you guys doing? Why don't you come over to the winners? You should start defecting to the winning side because you're clearly with the losers. Look what Cassius did. Look at what a fool he is. He doesn't believe in you guys. He's no longer with you. Why do you believe in yourselves? Or if that doesn't work, other pamphlets say, okay, so you believe in the Republican cause? Why don't you prove it? Why don't you come fight? Why are you hiding behind your lines? Come on, come to a battle. And the troops are getting really, really agitated. In fact, inside the camp, there are a number of prisoners of war that Brutus has captured from Antony and Octavian's forces. And the prisoners of war are mocking them as well. They're mocking what Cassius did. They're mocking the Republican cause. And Brutus doesn't know what to do with this. And so another one of the conspirators that had killed Julius Caesar, Casca, says, you got to kill them all. So Brutus does something very uncharacteristic, and he slaughters all the POWs. And Brutus is clearly, he's losing control of the men. What he should have done was he should have upbraided those men who had rushed into battle and praised their valor, but condemned them from the first battle of Philippi for not staying under his command. And then he should have reminded them, hey, what are we fighting for? And hey, we're going to win. And hey, I've got a plan and you need to stick with it. And if you don't, I'm going to punish you. But instead, the words that are described for how he treats them, he's kind, he's gentle, he's persuadable. These are not things that you want in a commander, especially in a moment like this. He needed to show that hard-edged republicanism that Cassius had shown, and he doesn't. Instead, what happens is his men are saying, we need to fight. Let's end this. Why are we being cowards? And he just kind of says, oh, well, you know, I got a good strategy. It'll work. I hope you come around to it. But eventually, all of this pressure from Antony, from the POWs, from his subordinates, from his own troops, it starts to wear on Brutus. And by the 23rd of October, he has now decided he has got to do something because his men are going to lure him into a battle. There's a famous line, and I'll read it to you, from Plutarch. This is what he says. He tells them, well, you have chosen to fight. You had forced me to battle when I could conquer otherwise. He's talking about this strategy of attrition. So Brutus says, they can gain in one day and by one blow provisions, money, ships, and camps, and the prizes of victory. But you force me to fight. This is not what a commander should be saying. A commander shouldn't say, all right, troops, you're making me do this. A commander should be saying, you're going to do this because it's the right thing to do, and I'm going to lead you, and this is going to work out great, and you're going to thank me in the end because I know what I'm doing. That's not Brutus' game. And so instead, what he does is he sets his forces up in battle array for one great last battle. And this is going to happen on the 23rd of October. This is the second battle of Philippi.
Dio's got a line as well saying that his troops thought of him as idle and cowardly like women, which I don't think is a great thing to be saying about women, but Dio's a bit old-fashioned that way, as he's allowed
sure.
to be.
It's very Roman this way, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like Brutus has completely lost control of his troops and is being led by his army. It's like he's got no say in the strategy at all.
What all the sources, to a certain extent, you could say, well, maybe they're trying to like put him as a stock character and we're trying to make a moral example. This is what Plutarch, for example, would do. But all the sources sort of create the same picture. And when you read some of the letters of Brutus, you also get hints of this as well. So it may be overstated a little bit, but I think all the information together presents a pretty good picture of a guy who's lost control of his forces. And the way the battle itself begins is the coup de grace, if you will. There is a really, really brave soldier, a guy by the name of Camulatus. And Camulatus has fought for the Republican cause. He's fought in the first battle of Philippi. Everyone respects him. Between the two battles that have now been arrayed, right? So they haven't started fighting, but they both mustered out, and everyone knows this is going to be a set piece battle, and you know it's going to determine the day. Camulatus walks out of the lines of the Republicans. You know, what are people thinking? They think, oh, is he going to like offer a duel? Is he going to, you know, do something really nasty to the opposing side? No, you know what he does? He defects. He publicly defects to the triumvirs. And when everyone sees this, can you imagine how disgraceful, how embarrassing this would be? And so people know we've got to get this going. And so this is what starts the battle. As soon as he defects, both sides basically march toward one another. And we're told they are so eager to come to blows and fight up close, they don't even throw their missiles. Usually you would throw two different kinds of javelins or pila, one a little lighter so you can throw it farther and one a little heavier. And they're meant to kill some of the opposing enemy or basically attrite the enemy forces, get stuck in shields, disrupt the enemy. But we are told, whether or not it's true, we don't know, but we are told they don't even do that. They're so eager to rush and get to each other and be able to stab each other and maim each other up close. We have these brutal descriptions of the fighting and how they're using their teeth, they're ripping at each other. together. They're hacking. It's mostly with a gladius, and a gladius is a particularly brutal kind of weapon. It's meant not only to thrust, but also to cut. Other people, when they fight the Romans, they would look at a battlefield and just be shocked because a spear blow like hits a vital organ, the person falls, but the body still looks pretty similar. A lot of blood loss, but it still looks pretty similar. But a gladius could hack off an arm. It could cut up a midsection. It could really bring out all the internal organs. And this is what these guys do when they come to blows with each other. Well, for a while, it looks like maybe the Republicans have a chance to win. Maybe that's what's going to happen. On the right wing now, it seems like Brutus is going to be able to maintain the initiative. The cavalry is victorious against Octavian's cavalry, and they start to envelop that left side of the triumvirate position. But what happens next is what decides the fate of the second battle, and that's that numerical inferiority. Because they have fewer troops, and because they've now started to extend themselves, they become overextended, and a gap emerges somewhere in the center right of the Republican position. And this is where Antony exploits that gap. They begin to envelop Brutus' position instead. So it looks like they're on the cusp of maybe being able to end it, and instead the polar opposite occurs. And now Brutus himself, all of his closest friends, rally to him. They are all enveloped by Antony's forces. And this is where this really heart-wrenching scene happens for Brutus. And this guy, I mean, how much more emotional trauma can he take? But he is defended by all of his closest friends, a number of the best Republican young nobles, guys that he was raised with, men who were alongside him when they decided to assassinate Caesar. These guys, they form this sort of shell around him, but they're all slowly starting to be cut to pieces. And so Brutus is sitting here watching many of his best friends and these last men sacrifice their lives to make sure he's alive. And with those images in his mind, that's when he realizes we've lost, and he flees and he goes up behind the city of Philippi up into the heights, and he looks over the scene. As he's doing this, this is where Antony, again taking the initiative, is going to mop up the remaining forces. And it's very clear in the sources, this is in Appian. Antony was everything and attacked everywhere, falling upon the fugitives and those who still held together, and upon their camping places, crushing all alike with vehement and impetuosity. Fearing lest the leader should escape him and collect another army, he dispatched cavalry upon the roads and outlets of the field of battle to capture those who were trying to escape. And there are several other little anecdotes that emerge. Some guys know the battle's lost. They know they're going to be executed. And so they rush into battle without any armor on. Or they go to their tents, they write their last wills, and then they have their slaves kill them. And basically, all of the Republican leadership that remains in the Roman Republic are slaughtered on the battlefield, either by their own hand or by Antony, all except for the small number of leaders who've escaped to that hilltop with Brutus. And the last scene is a fitting end to the tragedy of Brutus at Philippi. So Brutus goes up. He's got maybe four legions worth of men. It's a sizable force, but not against the numbers that the triumvirs have. He's clearly lost way too many to be able to sustain a defense. But he asks the men who are with him, "Will you fight for me?" And it's this bitter irony because the commanders who the very day before had been insisting he get out there and fight, these men say, "No, we're not going to fight for you. We're going to take care of ourselves. We're going to look to our own. We're going to head out, head south. We're going to go into the places. We're going to join the Pompeian forces that still have the seas." They all say, "We're not going to fight for you anymore." And so then Brutus realizes what has happened. And he decides, "Okay, I have one other request for you. It's my last request." He goes around, he starts shaking all of their hands, and he says, "Will one of you help me take my own life? It's hard to do on my own." And it's pathetic. None of them will help him take his own life. That's what he wants. He wants someone to help him commit suicide. And none of these men will even help him do this. So what Brutus then has to do is he goes out into a grove on his own, and he takes his sword, he fixes it on the ground, and he falls on it. And that is the end of the poor, pathetic Brutus.
That's also very Shakespearean. you said that a lot of the men surrendered. We actually get a lot of them going across to Antony and Octavian's forces. And it's actually kind of interesting in that entire retelling there. You said that Antony was everywhere at once and Antony pushed all of this advantage. And I'm sure that Octavian was there also in small letters somewhere in the battle.
He's there. He doesn't do anything conspicuous. But for Octavian, that's probably a pretty good thing just to be there.
Yeah,
but the emphasis clearly is on Antony. If you're a citizen soldier at this point, you know, the commanders are done. If you've heard of what's happened to Brutus, your best option is the only option to go over and hope they're merciful and that they incorporate you into the army. And, you know, maybe you might get something, who knows, but at least you'll be able to live. And that's the only choice that's really left. I mean, you could try to join another ragtag force that's out there, but really now it's just the seas, and that's going to quickly dwindle as well. But the land forces after the Battle of Philippi, that's it. And more importantly, there are no Republican commanders really left alive. The son of Pompey is not Republican to the bone like Casca or Brutus or Cassius or any of these guys who've been. No, everyone who is Republican to the bone by this point in time has died. And so they realize that's it. And so they're going to have to go over to the triumvirs. And whatever Rome the triumvirs fashion, that will be the Rome that they fight for and that they will be settled in.
And Antony does come across Brutus's body, and he's quite, I wouldn't say merciful because Brutus is already dead at this point, but he's very respectful of his final enemy, it seems, at this point.
We have a couple of different sources, but we are told that he does honor the body. A couple of movies that portray this really well. I think there's something to Antony. There's a sense of honor, especially someone who served Rome. There would certainly be things that Antony did not like about Brutus, and of course they disagreed about Brutus, but Antony was raised in the same Republican system that Brutus was. So for him to honor the body of Brutus and to send it back either to his mother, like cremated, or to send the body back, I think that Antony would feel this way. It's totally within the character of Antony. He can respect an opponent, and he can have a sense of morality and honor at times. Octavian is not the same way. Octavian has no kinds of moral scruples unless he's in a complete position of power. And this is something that will weigh down Antony. He's got this sense of honor and adventure that someone like Octavian doesn't have and doesn't feel in the same way. So it's fitting that this is the way that Brutus has his final testament. It's by an enemy. And that fits because if he's heard by this point in time, Antony was originally supposed to be murdered by the conspirators. That was their plan. And it was Brutus who said, no, we only kill the tyrant. Because we don't know that Antony's a tyrant. Now, later they'd figure that out. But at the time, Brutus had said, no, we're not going to kill Antony. And I think it's because he believed that Antony could work in a Republican system. Who knows? Maybe Antony had heard that and that influenced his decision.
And this is the last battle of the Roman Republic at this point. So do you think that there is a sense at the time that everything's going to change from here? I realize that Antony and Octavian probably realize that they are going to have to fight very soon and that things aren't going to stay as they are with a triumvirate in place. But for the fact for there to be no republic, do you think that there's the realization that this was the end of it?
I think by the time the sort of excitement of the battle wears off, I think most people would have understood that something different is going to emerge. And maybe we're going to have a couple of big commanders that rule. Maybe the triumvirate will stick around. Maybe it'll be whittled down to two. But it's not going to look like the same way it did. And that's what the next 11 years is. It's 11 years of trying to figure out, what do we have now that we no longer have the Republic? Because everyone who has sung the song of the Republic, they're dead. No one will sing that song again.
That was Dr. Steele Brand, Associate Professor of History at the King's College in New York City, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in all readily available podcatching platforms. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Steele is at Steele_Brand. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.